East Coast, I believe, Uncle. South of Madras. Strong French connections.
Oh, missionaries, I bet. Looking for contributions. Lawyers and missionaries. And all in one day. I wonder where they got my name. Oh, open it, will you, John? Mary, where's that coffee? Well, was all right? Hmm? An appeal to convert and feed the Hindu, huh? Well, come on, boy.
I rather think it's a joke, Uncle.
Joke? Oh, what sort of joke?
Well, just that all that is in the envelope is... Well, look. 5 pips. And on the envelope flap, the letters K...
They found me.
Uncle.
My sins have overtaken me.
Mary, a cloth from the kitchen.
Yes, sir.
Uncle, what is it? What on earth does it mean? The pips, the letters.
What do they mean?
Mr. Fordham, sir.
Good morning, Colonel. And to you, John. Ah, nothing like a brisk canter to give a man an appetite. I say, what have we here? Compote of fruit, kippers, kedgeree. So all that's wanted is a plate. Mary.
Mary, never mind a damn twaddle. Go to the kitchen. Bank up the fire now.
Yes, sir.
Fordham, for once, forget your stomach and earn your money.
I say, Openshaw.
Go to town, immediately. You understand me?
Why, I...
Draw my will. Everything is to pass to John's father initially. That is my brother Joseph. And after him, John here. Are you savvy?
But this is a little precipitate.
No,
surely.
Fordham, this is what I want. Now, do you understand?
Well, as you put it like
that... to daddle and get yourself busy and get back here to have it witnessed. Now, go! Give the job to a faster man.
Very well, Colonel.
John. John, I'm off to the kitchen. Now, you go to the locked room. I know you're not supposed to know about it. Here's the key. Now, I want you to bring down the brass box... There's only one. Hurry, John. Hurry. There's lots to do.
Uncle, the 5 pips. You were going to tell me what they mean.
They mean death, John. That's what they mean.
And did they mean death, Mr. Openshaw?
As requested, I brought the brass box to the kitchen. My uncle opened it with a key kept on his person and then proceeded to burn the contents, accepting one leaf of paper which fell, only charred, onto the hearth.
Ah, you have it?
Here, Mr. Holmes. Something, I know not what, told me to retrieve it without his knife.
Most interesting. But I shall need my lens on my table, if you would, Watson.
Of course, Holmes.
And shortly after this ritual burning, Fordham returned with the will, which was witness to the effect that in the event of my uncle Elias's death, the estate would revert to my father and then to me.
After which, I assume, his behaviour deteriorated rapidly.
Totally. He began drinking continually, would see no one at all, roamed the house with his gun at all hours, suddenly unlocking the doors and rushing out in the night to check noises he heard outside, taps that had come at his window.
Poor devil.
And the end?
A night when he made yet another drunken sally outside, yelling and cursing about those who were out to get him. He was found next morning face down in a little green scummed pool at the bottom of the garden.
And the coroner's verdict?
Suicide.
Suicide?
What else, given the circumstances? Yet no man had a stronger grasp on life than my uncle. However, my father and I simply entered into possession of the estate and £14,000 at the bank.
Remarkable. Truly remarkable. Now, Mr. Openshaw, let me have 2 dates, will you? Watson, make a note if you will.
Certainly.
First, the exact date of the letter containing the 5 pips, and then that of your uncle's suicide.
March the 10th, 1893, he received the letter. May the 2nd, 1893, his body was found... Exactly 7 weeks later.
And a Pondicherry postmark. I wonder. Perhaps it is yet too early. Pray proceed, Mr. Robinshaw.
So my father and I moved into the property, and in the attic room discovered that same brass box, inside the lid of which was pasted a label with those same initials that were on the envelope.
Mr. Robinshaw, what exactly were these initials?
Why, KKK.
Ah. And some words, you say?
Simply letters, memoranda, receipts, and a register.
That is the nature of the papers that your uncle destroyed.
It would appear so. And which same papers I tried to convince my father were directly responsible for my uncle's death. A suggestion he laughed away, saying the letter was a prank or warning from a firm of Florida orange growers my uncle had had business with in the past, and whose initials were KKK. Business, my father hinted, that may have involved perhaps some sort of financial irregularities.
And your father maintained this reading of the situation?
Unswervingly. Even when the second letter arrived, addressed to him.
Some more coffee, my boy.
Father, I implore you to listen. I firmly believe the first letter to Uncle Elias was both a warning and a statement of intent. I believe this one to you is also a warning, plus a request... A request of which you must take notice.
To put on the sundial papers that no longer exist, that Elias burnt,
I do not see how I can help the anonymous writer of this note. I do not even see how I can help myself to marmalade at this moment. It appears to be missing from the table. Although, should the writer call in person, I will gladly talk to him about it. From Dundee, was it? Well, Dundee is a long way.
So is Pondicherry.
John, I really see no use in pursuing this line again. Elias's death was self-inflicted in more ways than one. I don't know about you, my boy, but I find this toast rather crusty this morning.
At least let me contact the authorities on your behalf.
To lay what before them?
My father's safety.
Oh, very well. You recall Major Freebody, who commands the forts on Portsdown Hill, and who was continually inviting me over there to look at some lighting apparatus he has evolved, which he hopes to fit one day to his bicycle, though mark my words, it is the likes of Freebody who will have these wonderful machines of ours subject to Acts of Parliament before he's finished.
Father...
However, to calm your fears and satisfy his self-aggrandizement, I suppose for a few days, certainly no more than a week. How will that suit you?
I could hardly speak, so relieved was I at my father's decision. As I imagined, the further he was from home, the further from danger. Then, on the second day, I received a telegram to contact the Major. My father, having apparently missed his way the previous twilight, had been found at the bottom of one of many deep chalk pits in the area. Nothing missing, no signs of violence. Death from accidental causes.
Sympathies, Miss Robinshaw.
Thank you, gentlemen. But that was nearly 3 years ago, and not directly what brings me here today.
Then what does, Mr. Robinshaw?
These. Which arrived in a letter yesterday morning, and this time addressed to me.
Good Lord.
And the postmark?
London, Eastern Division.
Ah, the message?
To put the papers on the sundial, and signed with 3 Ks.
And what have you done?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Well, to tell the truth, gentlemen, my first feeling was one of complete helplessness, like a rabbit transfixed by a snake. I seemed to be in the grip of some relentless, inexorable evil. Well, then I thought of my uncle's fighting spirit and decided I'd make a stand.
Good man.
And so went to the police, who listened with a smile. But my standing and my dreadful earnestness eventually persuaded them to allot me a man.
Who is where?
Horsham. His orders are to stay in the house.
But why did you not come to me at once?
I did not know who to turn to. This morning, however, I decided as a gesture to come to town, which is how I met Prendergast, who directed me to you.
And well he did so. But you've left it late, very late. However, so, first the paper. Watson, The lamp directly overhead, if you will.
Yes, these charred edges make it difficult. But, yes, March 1869. Fourth, Hudson came, same old platform. Seventh set the pips on. Macaulay, Swain, and Paramore of St. Augustine. Ninth, Macaulay cleared. Tenth, John Swain cleared. Twelfth, visited Paramore. All well, which I think is all they'll get. Now, this is your uncle's hand, Mr. Robinshaw, on this scrap.
Without doubt. What do you think, Mr. Holmes?
That you return home immediately and put this remnant in the brass box, plus another note signed by yourself explaining the burning of the other papers. You must write this in a way that will carry conviction and put the box on the sundial as instructed.
And this will satisfy them?
I think it may deter them, to give us extra time to discover their identities and invoke the law.
You can really do this.
If Holmes cannot help you, Mr. Offenshaw, no one can.
Then I will return immediately.
Here, let me help you with it, Coulter. The sound of the wind is anything to go by. We'll still need it.
You go back by a train from Waterloo. Oh,
thank you. Yes, there is one at 9:30.
Then you must hurry, Mr. Robinshaw.
We'll take a cab, of course.
If there is one available in such weather. Even so, I am armed. One of my uncle's many pistols. Not that I'm sure how to use it.
The threat is often enough. Good, then set off, but take care, for you are in real and imminent danger, and tomorrow I will work upon your case.
In Horsham?
In London, Mr. Robinshaw, for that is where the answer lies. London, Eastern Division.
I saw Robinshaw downstairs and opened the front door. A cloak of wind swept past me with a howl and up the stairs. Watching Robinshaw being buffeted down Baker Street,
searching vainly for a cab. I thought of Holmes, warm and dry upstairs in our cozy rooms, already in an introspective silence in front of the red glow of the fire, his pipe alight, watching the wraiths of smoke chase each other towards the ceiling like strands of seaweed being fantastically wound in the middle of great green waves. Then...
Here, Watson, you're waterproof. Yeah. We must follow until he finds a hansom, even to the railway station itself. For it seems to me he walks in more perils than even the Sholtos did in the Sign of the Four. Quickly! He's near the corner.
But what are these perils? Who's behind all this?
You have some idea?
Indeed, but I can do no more until it's light. Until, in fact, the public libraries reopen in the morning. Should there be any doors left on them to open? Ah, he turns into Oxford Street.
You can tell me nothing?
You remember, Doctor, in the early days of our friendship, how you once defined my limitations?
Indeed. Philosophy, astronomy and politics, zero. Botany, variable. Geology, profound, as regards mudstains from any region within 50 miles of London. Chemistry, eccentric. Anatomy, unsystematic. Sensational literature, crime records, unique. Then, violinist, boxer, swordsman, lawyer, and self-poisoner by cocaine and tobacco.
Yeah. Anatomy unsystematic. Well, Doctor, what can you tell me about Cuvier's feather, or bone, as some refer to it?
Oh, I'm not sure I can tell you anything. Although I seem to have heard, when a student...
Cuvier was a French comparative anatomist whose great coup de théâtre was to take a fossilized feather that had been found belonging to no known species of bird and from it adduce the shape of the bird's wing. From the wing, the body, from the body, the head, from the head. Well, needless to say, Cuvier prophesied what the whole creature would look like should one ever be found. And when one was...
Remarkable. Well, what is Cuvier?
Now, if our feather is what drove Colonel Oppenshaw from the charming climate of Florida and all his American friends and contacts for the life of a semi-recluse in an English provincial town, I think we may adduce fear. But fear of what? Oxford Street. There he goes. Now keep close to the shops. Should he glance back?
Holmes, fear of what?
This we learn from the letters. You recall again their postmarks.
Mm-hmm. Pondicherry, Dundee, London. That is East London.
Mm-hmm. From which we deduce...
whole seaports.
Excellent, my dear Watson. So there can be no doubt that the writer of them is on a ship. So let us look further. In the case of Pondicherry, 7 weeks elapsed between the threat contained in the letter and the threat's fulfilment. In Dundee, it was 3 or 4 days. So?
Well, those involved had a greater distance to travel.
But then the letter surely had the same distance to come and therefore should have arrived with the sender, should it not?
What on earth are you driving at?
That from the information we hold, we can adduce the sort of ship, a sailing ship. It looks as if the malefactors in this matter always send their singular warning to their intended victim before beginning their mission. I believe they sent their first letter by steam mail packet from Pondicherry, arriving themselves 7 weeks later on a sailing ship. Much less reliable, usually very much slower.
Of course. This would explain why the second letter from Dundee arrived 3 days before they did. The time it took them to sail round the coast, their letter coming overland.
The third letter, though, comes from London, Eastern Division, that is, the East India Dock.
My God! They're already here.
Which is exactly why we are dogging John Oppenshaw's footsteps on such a night.
Holmes, who is it we're looking for? What do they want? How will you find them?
Ah, at last.
Strange tableau. Just one cab in an almost deserted Oxford Street. When you consider the carts jamming the middle of this thoroughfare during the day. Every day. And always in the middle.
That, Watson, is because the camber of the road is an added hazard to already overburdened horses. Ah, he's safely inside. So, let us lay off a course for Baker Street with all possible dispatch. You want to know the who and why as regards John Oppenshaw?
Mm-hmm.
Well, after a small restorative, I shall do my very best to enlighten you. We shall be home, I trust, before Mr. Oppenshaw even steps aboard his train.
McGregor! He's broke off 2 points! We'll have to try to wear her!
Aye, sir! I'll have Carver start the watch!
Everyone from the point of the old sails! We'll run the trail on the grave!
It's along here. A barge called Betsy. My mate will let me lie up there till my ankle's healed. Oh!
You must keep it off the ground. Put your arm more round my shoulder. Where is this boat? It is essential I catch the 9:30 train from the station. It's so dark under here.
Oh, There it is, Mr. Openshaw. Just at the end of that small jetty. On the river itself. Something wrong?
You called me Mr. Openshaw.
So I did. But that doesn't matter now, does it?
Here you are, Doctor.
Ah, thank you.
While I put this towel to use, oblige me by handing down the letter K of the American Encyclopedia from the bookshelf, would you?
Mm.
You see, one person couldn't possibly have carried out the two murders. They were simply too well planned and executed. Offenshaw's uncle Elias was a strong, capable, determined fighter. Subdue him and hold his head under in a pond would require two, maybe three, equally determined men. The sort of men who battle daily with the sort of weather we are now experiencing outside, and for whom a fall into the raging ocean and loss of life itself is simply another part of the daily round. Ah, thank you. So, to continue my Cuvier analogy, we are therefore not looking for one person, but a group of people. And in this way, KKK becomes the badge of a society, rather than that of an individual. Of the Ku Klux Klan, in fact.
Never heard of it.
So, here it is. Ku Klux Klan. A name derived from the fanciful resemblance to the sound produced by cocking a rifle. Terrible secret society formed by ex-Confederate soldiers in southern states, notably Tennessee, Louisiana, Carolinas, Georgia, Florida. Terrorizing of Negro voters, murdering and driving from country those opposed to its views. Outrages usually preceded by warnings sent to marked man by fantastic but generally recognized shape, sprig of oak, melon seeds, or orange pips. Yes, in spite of best efforts of the United States government, movement flourished until eventually 1869, movement seemed rather suddenly to collapse.
The time Elias came back to England.
Bringing with him the papers. Papers, I suspect, that would perhaps now incriminate some of the first men of the South. Yes, now consider again the leaf that fell from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Sent the pips to A, B, C, A and B, leaving the country, C being visited with, I fear, a sinister result. Now this was evidence to be destroyed or suppressed at any cost. A task given to the men from the ship.
But the papers are no more, and Elias dead. There is now no more danger to anyone involved in this society.
Well, the pursuers are not to know this, at least not until tomorrow when they find John Openshaw's note.
Will they believe it? I have no idea.
You see, I think the men questioned Elias before drowning him, but would have had no means of deciding the truth, because Elias would have claimed all the papers burned, but had nothing to show them one way or the other. But with the proof now of the charge sheet...
Would they not have searched the house after killing Elias?
No, they would have expected Elias to live alone. Given his character, would not have allowed for his nephew being there, and secrecy is essential to the aims of their society.
And once Elias was dead, of course, only the papers could then incriminate the principals.
Indeed. So they threatened John's father, Joseph, for them. A stubborn man, he refused to make known what he knew, which cost him his life. But, as it said in the encyclopedia, they exist through fear. And will now hope to have scared Offenshaw to the point where he'll give them anything he has.
What devils? What do you intend to do?
Deliver them to the law.
But how? When you've no idea where they are. When there are 1,000 ships in the East India docks.
That is tomorrow. So tonight, hand me my violin, and we'll try to forget for half an hour the miserable weather outside and still more miserable ways of our fellow men.
The next morning, the weather had cleared and the sun was again weakly shining. Holmes arose early and in a positive fever of impatience, refusing one of Mrs. Hudson's stout bachelor breakfasts, refusing to glance at the morning papers, departing with hardly a goodbye. Left alone, I began to turn over those same papers, at first indiscriminately, then with a heavy heart. The morning wore slowly into midday and then into afternoon, but still there was no sign of Holmes. Finally, tired from my own inaction, sick with a sense of failure, weary from good motives turned by chance to bad deeds, I lay on the couch to rest. And while lying there, ran again over the fantastical story told to us by John Openshaw, amused on his life with his uncle, the sensitive, timid boy, and his immersion into the end of a very deep pool, his relationship with Elias, and where it eventually brought him. Evening began to close in, fantasy to merge with fact as the long day waned. I half dreamt the bell had rung, and Openshaw was again mounting the stairs for the first time, that we would be given another chance, that...
Ah, Watson! Success, I think. Up you get and listen to this.
Holmes, have you seen...
Later, my dear fellow. Lord, I'm hungry. Nothing all day. Let me get myself some roast beef. There's a good fellow.
Holmes.
Yeah, some mustard. Watson, I know who they are, the murderers. Their names, where they're from, where they're going, everything. Ah, that's quiet, isn't you? Let me explain. Now, first I went to the library for the old shipping papers and checked all the vessels in Pondicherry around January and February of 83, then all the vessels in Dundee, January 85, finally all the vessels in East India docks up until yesterday, which led me, by a process of elimination, to a sailing ship, the Lone Star, the name of one of the states of the Union.
Texas.
Indeed. Proof in itself, almost. Then to Roy's to see my old friend Captain Standish. You remember the case of the singular stowaway? Of course you do. Standish looked through the lists and found the details. Lone Star, home port, Savannah. Captain James Cahoon, agents near the Albert Dock. At the agents, I inquired about a passage to America, citing reports of Captain Cahoon's seamanship as my reason for choosing the ship. By this ruse, I learned Cahoon and his first and second mates, McGregor and Carver, were the only Americans aboard, the rest being Finns and Germans, that Cahoon was sometimes inclined take a passenger or two, but not this time, the Lone Star having cleared early this morning for Savannah. I realized immediately that Cahoon and his associates must have collected the paper from the sundial late last night prior to sailing this morning. Well, they may have their scrap of burned paper, but I have their names and all other details, which will be forwarded to the proper authorities, though not until I have bathed and rested. And after... why, perhaps a trip to Horsham to acquaint John Openshaw with the solution to his problem. What do you say, old fellow?
I'm afraid it would be a wasted journey, Holmes.
Here. The heading is Tragedy near Waterloo Bridge.
Between 9 and 10 last night, Constable Cook of H Division faint cry for help, splash. What with wind and rain, impossible to effect rescue. Body eventually... recovered by water police. From envelope in pocket, John Openshaw. Conjectured deceased, hurrying to catch last train from Waterloo Station. Tripped over small boat's landing jetty, no doubt victim of unfortunate accident. Only hope this will call attention of authorities to deplorable general condition of riverside landing stages.
What was he doing on the embankment at all? The cabby should have taken him directly to...
Let me look again. When interviewed, the hansom cab driver said his horse was of a nervous disposition in high wind and that he was therefore loath to take the animal onto the exposed bridge and so dropped his fare at the Aldwych end near the Strand.
Oh, well, of course, one of them would have been waiting for him, just as another would be on the train, just as the third would have been at Horsham. Cahoon, McGregor, Carver, each commanding his own piece of ground. Oh, how easy we made it for them.
Holmes, you must not blame yourself. You really have no cause
to. The worst thing, Watson, is that it hurts my pride. Now, considering Openshaw is dead and that I sent him to his death, God knows her pride is the last thing I should be feeling, that he should come to me for help. The devils. I did not look far enough. Devils. Devils. But he shall not remain unavenged. Watson, an orange from that cupboard. Huh?
You are, but
thank you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Envelope, pen, and address to Captain James Cahoon, Bark, Lone Star, Savannah, Georgia. To go by mail boat and be waiting for our friend Captain Cahoon when he arrives. Will give him a sleepless night when he will feel something of what John Openshaw felt, and I will ensure the police will wait on him the next day. You see, they gave him a day to put the papers on the sundial, as they had only until the next morning before they left. When he did not comply, they killed him, assuming that with the last of the Oppenshaws dead, their secret would be safe. Well, I will put a pack of dogs on them they will not shake off, no matter how fast and hard they sail.
It may not come to that. Have a look here. This report concerning the weather. How the storm that has just passed over London is now expected to move out to sea, heading for the Goodwins and the Isle of Wight.
Yes. They may not be too far from there at this moment. I wonder, Watson, if this time a higher authority has not intervened to exact a most ultimate justice. If so, it is a salutary lesson. Not least to me.
And so, we think it transpired. For the Lone Star never made port, and for all we know, Holmes's letter, with its dried-up orange pips, still lies yellowing in an agent's office in Savannah. Some long time later, Holmes again had occasion to meet Captain Standish of Lloyd's on another matter. And, not unnaturally, the name of the Lone Star eventually came up between them. After a moment's pause, Standish mentioned how, months before, the skipper of a packet for Boston had claimed, far out in the Atlantic, to have seen a shattered sternpost swinging in the trough of a wave. The man had immediately called for his glass and turned it upon the splintered remnant of wood moving to and fro in the water. The carved letters it bore, he claimed, were simply L.S.
With that last one, Carver to...
Back! Stay here in the wheel! I'll take the axe! Haul myself along the pin rail, then cut the stays away from the outside bulwarks! Try to keep her to the sea! We clear the mast, she might right herself! Give her a chance to move the ballast! Wish me luck, man!
Captain! Captain Calhoun, no! Not yet! Wait! Coming on the quarter again! Look out, sir!
And that is all we ever knew concerning the fate of the Lone Star.
In The Five Orange Pips, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Medicine and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. Elias Oppenshaw was played by Brian Green and John Oppenshaw by Angus Wright. With Danielle Allen as Mary the Maid, Michael Turner as Joseph Oppenshaw and Captain Calhoun, and Brett Usher as Fordham and McGregor. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Five Orange Pips was dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney and directed by Patrick Rayner.
Speak to you, Rachel.
You'd better come in before you wake the other servants. Well, Mr. Brenton, and what do you have to say for yourself that can't wait till morning?
I had to see you.
You fancy woman's thrown you over, she?
Rachel, please. There's never really been anyone else but you.
You have a strange way of showing it.
I know I don't deserve another chance, but when you realize, when you look into your heart and find there's only one person you really love, then you have to ask for that chance. If necessary, you will even beg for it. Because you know. Because I know. I love you, Rachel. I always have. I always will.
I don't know what to say.
There's only one thing you have to say. That you give me that chance. That you won't turn me away. That you will let me love you.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
missed you so much. So much. Hush now. Hush. We don't want to wake Mr. Musgrave, do we?
The Musgrave Ritual by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio by Peter Mackey. With Clive Medicine as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Robert Dawes as Reginald Musgrave. The Musgrave Ritual.
An anomaly which often struck me in the character of my friend Sherlock Holmes was that, although in his methods of thought he was the neatest and most methodical of men, he was nonetheless in his personal habits one of the most untidy. With me there is a limit, and when I find cigars in the coal scuttle, tobacco in the toe end of a Persian slipper, and unanswered correspondence transfixed by a jackknife into the very centre of the wooden mantelpiece, then I begin to give myself virtuous airs. His papers were my great crux, for he had a horror of destroying documents, especially those which were connected with his past cases. One winter's night, as we sat together by the fire, I ventured to suggest that he might employ the next 2 hours in making our room a little more habitable. With a somewhat rueful face, he went off to his bedroom, from which he returned presently, pulling behind him a large tin box.
Give me a hand, would you, Watson?
Yes, of course.
The box seems to have caught on the edge of the carpet. You just push from that end.
Right. Ready when you are.
Right. Now. Oh!
Are you all right, Watson?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think so. Good.
No bones broken anyway. Yeah. Must be stronger than we thought, eh, Holmes?
No more than we deserve for trying to box clever. Mm-hmm.
Oh, box clever.
Really, Holmes. I do apologise.
None required.
Box clever. Yeah, it wouldn't do for Mrs. Hudson to come in just now, lying on the floor like two naughty schoolboys.
No, it wouldn't do at all.
Well, though I do suspect there may well be something of the naughty schoolgirl in Mrs. Hudson.
Oh, steady on, Holmes. Do you think so?
Anything's possible.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose it is.
Mm. Oh, I must say, this carpet is really rather comfortable.
Mm. And kind to the knees.
You know, Holmes, you really are quite impossible at times.
Don't doubt it.
I'm supposed to be clearing out the room. You're making it worse by cluttering up with that box of yours.
You should be aware, Watson, that this box is about to play an important part in the evacuation of the so-called litter you complain of.
Oh, really?
Well, by discarding some of its contents, I shall make room for those very papers which seem to offend your passion for tidiness.
I watch with interest.
Yes, please do, please do. The case is enough here, Watson. If you only knew what was in this box. Records of my early work.
Really? I've often wished I had notes on that.
Yes, all done prematurely before my biographer had come to glorify me. Well, not all successes, of course, but there are some pretty little problems among them. Yes, the Tarleton murders. Nasty business. Vanbury the wine merchant. Clever man, clever. The old Russian woman. Well. Oh, the singular affair of the aluminium crutch.
Aluminium crutch.
Ricoletti of the club foot and his abominable wife and... Now, this really is something a little recherché. Box within a box. What do you make of the contents?
I see now. Crumpled piece of paper... Old-fashioned brass key.
Mm-hmm.
A peg of wood with a ball of string attached to it. And three rusty old discs of metal. Yeah, a curious collection.
Yes, well, the story that hangs around it will strike you as even more curious still. These relics have a history, then?
So much so that they are history. They're all I have left to remind me of the adventure of the Musgrave Ritual.
Oh, yes, I seem to recall the name.
I may have referred to the matter.
If it's all the same to you, Holmes, I shall be glad to have an account of it now.
Yes? Well, and leave the litter as it is. Oh, no, surely the strain would be too much for you to bear, Watson. Well, I should be glad if you'd care to add this case to your chronicles, for there are points in it which make it quite unique in the criminal records of this, or, I believe, of any other country. When I first came to London, I had rooms in Montague Street. You can hardly realize how difficult it was then to establish myself as a consulting detective. And so, as the British Museum was just round the corner, it was there I waited, filling in my too abundant leisure time by studying all those branches of science which might make me more efficient. As luck would have it, however, I happened to be at home on one of the comparatively rare occasions on which I had a caller, Reginald Musgrave, whom I'd not seen since we were undergraduates together 4 years previously.
Good to see you again, Holmes.
How's all gone with you, Musgrave?
You probably heard of my poor father's death.
Yes, I am sorry. About 2 years ago, wasn't it?
Well, I suppose it must be.
Hmm.
Since then, I have, of course, had the Hurlstone estate to manage, and as I am a member for my district as well, my life has been a busy one. But you, Holmes, I understand that you are turning to practical ends those powers with which you used to amaze us.
Oh, party pieces. There's nothing more.
Nonsense. What about the time... Oh, now, what was the fellow's name? Stanton. That's it. Harry Stanton. He would have been out on his ear if it hadn't been for you.
I was able to throw a little light on the affair.
A little light? You only unravelled a mystery which was beyond everyone else. Still don't know how you did it.
In answer to your question, yes, I have taken to living by my wits.
I am delighted to hear it, for your advice at present would be exceedingly valuable to me.
I am at your service. Now, please, do sit down.
Oh, thank you. Well, we have had some very strange doings at Hurlstone, and the police are about as baffled as I am. It really is the most extraordinary and inexplicable business.
Perhaps you would care to recount it.
You must know that though I am a bachelor, I have to keep up a considerable staff of servants at Hurlstone. It's a rambling old place and takes a good deal of looking after. I preserve, too, and in the pheasant months I usually have a house party, so that it would not do to be short-handed. Altogether, there are 8 maids, the cook, the butler, 2 footmen, and a boy. Of these servants, the one who's been longest in our service is Brunton, the butler.
Always as a butler?
Yes.
Yes.
He was a young schoolmaster out of the place when he was first taken up by my father. But he was a man of great energy and character, and he soon became quite invaluable in the household. Handsome fellow, too, with a splendid forehead. And though he has been with us for 20 years, he cannot be more than 40 now. Extraordinary chap. Very gifted, speaks several languages, plays just about every musical instrument you can think of.
Oh, really?
In fact, it's just amazing that he should have been satisfied so long in such a position.
A paragon, indeed.
But this paragon has one fault. He's a bit of a Don Juan.
Ah.
It was all right when he was married, but since he's been a widower, we've had no end of trouble with him. A few months ago, we were in hopes that he was about to settle down again, for he became engaged to Rachel Howells.
And she is?
Our second housemate. Yeah. But he has since thrown her over for another. Rachel, who is a very good girl, but of an excitable Welsh temperament.
Ah, the Welsh.
She had a sharp touch of brain fever. Now she goes about the house, or did until yesterday, like a black-eyed shadow of her former self. That was our first drama at Hurlstone. May I have a cigarette?
No, oh, my dear fellow. Please help yourself.
Thank you.
I'll join you. You say that was the first drama.
Yes, but the second came to drive it from our minds, and it was prefaced by the disgrace and dismissal of Brunton. One day, last week, Thursday night to be more exact, I just couldn't sleep. Rather foolishly, I'd taken a cup of strong café noir after my dinner. About 2 in the morning, I gave up the struggle and went to fetch the novel I'd left in the billiard room. Having descended a flight of stairs and reached the head of the passage leading to the gun room, you can imagine my surprise when I looked down the corridor and saw a glimmer of light coming from the open door of the library. Naturally, my first thought was of burglars, So, having armed myself with one of the old weapons that decorate the walls, I tiptoed down the passage and peeped in at the open door. Brunton was sitting there in an easy chair, fully dressed, with a slip of paper which looked like a map upon his knee.
A map?
I stood dumb with astonishment, watching him from the darkness. Suddenly, he rose from the chair, walked over to a bureau, unlocked it, and took out a second paper from one of the drawers. Then he returned to his seat and began to study it with minute attention. What is the meaning of this, Brunton?
Who? Oh, Mr. Musgrave, sir, I was...
You choose to examine our family documents like some thief in the night. Do you have an explanation?
That is no, sir.
So, this is how you repay the trust we have reposed in you. You will leave my service tomorrow.
But, sir, Mr. Musgrave...
That will be all. Did you hear me, Brunton?
Yes, sir. But, Mr. Musgrave, sir, I can't bear disgrace, sir. I've always been proud above my station in life, and disgrace would kill me. My blood will be on your head, sir. It will, indeed, if you drive me to despair. If you cannot keep me after what is past, then for God's sake let me give you notice and leave in the month, as if of my own free will. I could stand that, Mr. Musgrave, but not to be cast out before all the folk that I know so well.
You don't deserve such consideration. Your conduct has been most infamous. However, as you have been a long time in the family, I have no wish to bring public disgrace upon you. A month, however, is too long. Take yourself away in a week, and give what reason you like for going.
Only a week, sir? A fortnight? Say at least a fortnight.
A week. And you may consider yourself to have been very leniently dealt with.
Very good, sir.
Good night, Mr. Musgrave.
Tell me, what was on the paper Brunton took from the bureau?
Well, that's what was so odd about the whole business. It was nothing of any importance at all.
Let me be the judge of its significance.
Of course. It was simply a copy of an old observance called the Musgrave Ritual. It is a ceremony peculiar to our family, which over the centuries each Musgrave has gone through on his coming of age.
I see. Please, go on.
For 2 days after this, Brunton was most assiduous in his attention to his duties. I made no allusion to what had passed and waited with some curiosity to see how he would cover his disgrace. On the third morning, however, he did not appear after breakfast to receive my instructions for the day. As I left the dining room, I happened to meet the maid, Rachel Howells. Good morning, Rachel.
Morning, sir.
Rachel, is there something wrong?
No, Mr. Musgrave, sir.
Let me take a look at you.
I'm quite well, sir.
Not in my book. You're dreadfully pale. I'm not so sure you've recovered from that illness of yours. You'd better take yourself off to bed. Come back to your duties when you're stronger.
I'm strong enough, Mr. Musgrave.
We'll see what the doctor says. You must stop work now, and when you go downstairs, just say that I wish to see Brunton.
The butler's gone.
Gone where?
He's gone. He's not in his room. No one's seen him. Oh, yes, he's gone. He's gone!
The girl was taken to her room, still screaming and sobbing, while I made inquiries about Brunton. There was no doubt that he had disappeared. His bed had not been slept in. He had been seen by no one since he had retired to his room the night before, and yet it was difficult to see how he could have left the house, as both windows and doors were found to be fastened in the morning. His clothes, his watch, and even his money were in his room. But the black suit which he usually wore was missing. His slippers, too, were gone. But his boots were left behind.
Boots? Presumably a search was made of the house and the grounds.
There was no trace of him. I called in the local police, but without success. Then came a new development which quite drew our attention away from the original mystery. For 2 days, Rachel Howes had been so ill, sometimes delirious, that a nurse had been employed to sit up with her. On the third night after Brunton's disappearance, the nurse had apparently dozed off and woke in the early morning to find the bed empty, the window open, and no signs of the invalid. We followed her footmarks across the lawn to the edge of the mere, where they vanished close to the gravel path which leads out of the grounds. The lake there is 8 feet deep. And you can imagine our feelings when we saw that the trail of the poor demented girl came to an end at the edge of it.
Indeed.
I had the lake dragged at once, of course, but we could find no trace of the body.
I'm not surprised.
However, what we did bring to the surface was an object of the most unexpected kind. A linen bag, which contained within it a mass of old rusted and discoloured metal and several dull-coloured pieces of pebble or glass. This strange find was all that we could get from the mere, and although we made every possible search and inquiry yesterday, we know nothing of the fate of either Rachel Howells or Richard Brunton. The county police are at their wits' end, and I've come up to you as a last resource.
Yes, excellent. Let us see if we cannot piece together this extraordinary sequence of events and devise some common thread upon which they might all hang. And yet I suspect that of all the factors in this case, not one of them gets quite to the heart of the matter.
In what way?
We must get to the starting point of this chain of events. There lies the end of this tangled line. Do you have a copy of that paper, Musgrave?
Yes, but I doubt if it will help.
Oh, your butler thought it worth consulting, even at the risk of the loss of his place.
Well, it's rather an absurd business, this ritual of ours. But it has at least the saving grace of antiquity to excuse it. As you can see, it's in question-and-answer form, a strange catechism to which each Musgrave had to submit when he came to man's estate.
Whose was it? His who is gone. Who shall have it?
He who will come.
Where was the sun?
Over the oak.
Where was the shadow?
Under the elm.
How was it stepped?
North by 10 and by 10. East by 5 and by 5, south by 2 and by 2, west by 1 and by 1, and so under.
Under. What shall we give for it?
All that is ours.
Why should we give it?
For the sake of the trust.
Yes, a strange catechism indeed.
The original has no date, but is in the spelling of the middle of the 17th century. I'm afraid it's of little help in solving this mystery.
Well, at least it gives us another mystery, and one which is even more interesting than the first. You'll excuse me, Musgrave, if I say that your butler appears to me to have been a very clever man and to have had a clearer insight than 10 generations of his masters.
I hardly follow you. The paper seems to me to be of no practical importance.
But to me it seems immensely practical, and I fancy that Brunton took the same view. He'd probably seen it before that night on which you'd caught him.
Very possible. We took no pains to hide it.
He simply wished, I imagine, to refresh his memory upon that last occasion. The other piece of paper you saw was no doubt some sort of map or chart which he was comparing with the manuscript.
But what could he have to do with this old family custom of ours? What does it all refer to?
I don't think we should have much difficulty in determining that. With your permission, we'll take the first train down to Sussex and go a little more deeply into the matter on the spot.
And what spot was that?
Hurlstone.
Aye.
You may have seen pictures or read about the place, Watson. It's quite a famous building.
Yes, I was there once. Built in the shape of an L, as I remember.
You have it, yes. The longer arm is the modern portion, with the shorter being the ancient nucleus from which the other was developed.
Just how ancient?
1607. At least that's what's chiselled over the old doorway, but experts are agreed that the beams and stonework are really much older than that. But it was the enormously thick walls and tiny windows that drove the family into building the new wing, and the old one was then used as a storehouse and a cellar, when it was used at all. There was a splendid park, too, with fine old timber, and the lake, as I recall, lay about 200 yards from the house.
Yes, yeah, a beautiful spot.
By now I was convinced that if I could read the Musgrave ritual aright, it would give me the clue that would lead to the truth concerning both the butler Brunton and the maid Howells, and it was to this that I now turned all my energies. Mm-hmm. The question that still vexed me, however, was why should this servant be so anxious to master the old formula?
Presumably he saw something in it from which he expected to gain personal advantage.
Exactly. Now, it was perfectly obvious to me when I read the ritual that the measurements must refer to some spot to which the rest of the document alluded. Further, that if I could locate that spot, I should be a fair way towards finding the secret that the old Musgraves had thought it necessary to embalm in so curious a fashion. Two guides had been given, an oak and an elm. As the dogcart bringing us from the station proceeded up the drive, there was no doubt in my mind as to precisely which was the first tree referred to. For there, right in front of the house, stood a patriarch among oaks.
There it is, Musgrave.
What a magnificent tree. It wouldn't surprise me if that was there when your ritual was drawn up.
It was there at the Norman Conquest, in all probability. It has a girth of 23 feet.
Certainly one of our fixed points secured. I just need the elm now.
Whoa there! Whoa! Whoa, whoa! Steady, boy. Steady. There used to be an old one just there. Struck by lightning 10 years ago when we cut down the stump.
You still remember where it used to be then?
See for yourself.
It's quite a scar. There are no other elms.
No old ones?
I suppose it's impossible to find out how high this tree was.
64 feet.
Huh? How'd you come to know that?
When my old tutor used to give me exercises in trigonometry, it always took the shape of measuring heights.
Ah.
When I was a lad, I worked out every tree and building on the estate.
Well, lucky for us, you did. Tell me, did your butler ever ask you about the height of the tree?
Well, come to think of it, yes. He did. Some months ago, mind you. Said it was in connection with some little argument with the groom.
Excellent. Well, we seem to be on the right road. Tell me, Musgrave, it's late afternoon. How long would you say it will be before the sun lies just above the topmost branches of the old oak? About an hour?
Probably less.
Yes, which means that one condition mentioned in the ritual would then be fulfilled. Where was the sun?
Over the oak.
Where was the shadow?
Under the elm.
The shadow of the elm must mean the farther end of the shadow, otherwise the trunk would have been chosen as the guide. We have then to find where the far end of the shadow falls when the sun is just clear of the oak.
A bit difficult now the elm is no longer here.
Brunton could do it, so can we. Come, Musgrave, we've some preparations to make. I suggest your study would be a suitable place. Meanwhile, I should be obliged if you'd send for a 6-foot rod, 2 wooden pegs and a ball of string. So, Musgrave, if you'd stand exactly where the elm used to be...
Right.
You have to keep the rod as upright as you can.
Oh, of course.
Now, if I take the string and lay it along the line of the shadow to here... let's see now. 1, 2, 3 knots, 9 feet. I think the arithmetic's fairly simple. A rod of 6 feet throws a shadow of 9. A tree of 64 feet would throw one of 96. Do you agree with my calculation?
Certainly.
Yes, and if you'd be so kind as to peg this end of the string at the foot of the elm, while I measure out the distance in line with the... Oh. I need a bit more slack, Musgrave.
Fine.
Yes. 25, 26, 8, 29. Yeah, everything all right at your end?
All secure.
All right. 30, 31, and 32. Another peg. Over here, Musgrave, quickly now. Well, 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 well.
Found something, Holmes.
Yes, take a look at this.
Where's that?
On the ground, just where I placed my peg.
Well, looks like some sort of depression. Well, it's as if... Well, it's
as if someone's placed a peg no more than 2 inches from my own.
Brunton?
That may well prove to be the case. Now, at this point, if I remember right, the ritual said it was stepped. Yes, what was it? North 10 by 10, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
So if the sun is setting...
I took the precaution of bringing my pocket compass, which tells me... Yes, our path lies in this direction. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
We're going parallel to the house.
8, 9, 10.
Well, just think.
11,
we could be close 12, to solving the riddle 13, that's puzzled my family 14, for centuries.
15, 16, 17. Now, as long as that throws some light on your two missing servants. This is 18, 19, 20. Now, peg this point, would you, Musgrave?
Right.
Good, good. Now, compass, compass, compass to the east, I believe.
By 5 and by 5.
5 and 5. Very well. 2, 3, 4.
Straight
five,
to the original
six,
part of the house.
7, 8, 9, 10.
South? Huh. I'll open the door for you.
By 2 and by 2. And finally, by 1 and by 1. Nothing. Nothing but a flagstone. Oh, even worse, a flagstone that seems to be firmly cemented down and has certainly not been moved for many a long year.
So Brunton has not been here?
I'm beginning to have my doubts. And yet I'm still not convinced. The old part of the house. The fact that Brunton was following the same route.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, that's hollow flagstones, cracks, crevices. Anything that might suggest some sort of hiding place.
Well, I'd better check the manuscript again. Oh, I don't see how we could... 10 by 10, east 5 by 5. Well, we couldn't have made a mistake there. South by 2 and by 2, that brought us to the door there. Well, that must have been right.
I do not doubt it. We can hardly have erred on the final instruction by 1 and by 1.
No.
I propose we examine every flag in this corridor. Perhaps you'd care to give me a hand, Musgrave. Musgrave?
And under. By 1 and by 1, and so under.
Of course. Well, I take it there's a cellar under here.
As old as the house itself. Down here. Through this door.
Right.
Stairs are a bit narrow, so watch your step, Holmes. Look, I'd better go first. Oh, can't have been down here for a year or more. As far as I know, it's only used for storing wood. Oh, okay, careful now. You're on the last step.
Right.
Better stay there. Now, as I remember, there used to be a lantern over here. Ah, oh, yes. Shan't be a moment. There.
The light of the lantern showed that the cellar room was indeed used for the storage of wood, but the billets, which had evidently been littered over the floor, were now piled high at the sides, so as to leave a clear space in the middle. In this space lay a large and heavy flagstone with a rusted iron ring in the centre, to which a thick shepherd's check muffler was attached. And despite my anxiety to get to the bottom of the mystery without further delay, I suggested that 2 representatives of the county constabulary be called before making any attempt to lift the flagstone, for, as Musgrave was able to confirm, the muffler attached to the iron ring had belonged to none other than Brunton, the missing butler.
Watch your step, Middleton.
At last.
Seems to be a light at the bottom.
Is that you, Sergeant Harris?
Oh, Mr. Musgrave, sir. He said you were down here.
This is Mr. Holmes from London, who's been making certain inquiries on my behalf.
How do you do, sir?
Harris.
I think we can proceed now, Holmes.
Yeah, of course. Well, gentlemen, now we are all assembled, I believe the time has come to reveal what may lie underneath this flagstone. I'm sure Brunton would have no objections to my utilising the muffler he so thoughtfully provided. So... I think we can safely assume that Brunton also required assistance. Sergeant Harris, if you'd be so kind.
Certainly, Mr. Holmes.
I'm sure that between us, you...
A bit more, sir. That's it, I've got it.
Well done. Now, if we can just slide it over to... there. Now, Musgrave, the lantern, if you please... As Musgrave stepped forward and lowered the lantern through the black hole that the stone had been covering, it revealed a small chamber about 7 feet deep and 4 feet square. At one side of this was a squat, brass-bound wooden box, the lid of which was hinged upward with a curious old-fashioned key projecting from the lock. It was furred outside by a thick layer of dust, and damp and worms had eaten through the wood, so that a crop of living fungi was growing on the inside of it. Several discs of metal were scattered over the bottom of the box, but it contained nothing else. At that moment, however, I, Musgrave, and the 2 officers had no thought for the old chest, for our eyes were riveted upon that which crouched beside it.
My God!
It was the figure of a man clad in a suit of black, who squatted down upon his hands with his forehead sunk upon the edge of the box and his 2 arms thrown out on each side of it. The attitude had drawn all the stagnant blood to the face, and no man could have recognized that distorted, liver-colored countenance. But when we'd drawn the body up, his height, his dress, and his hair were all sufficient to show his former master that it was indeed his missing butler. He's been dead for some days. No wound. No bruising. Just... Sergeant Harris, the body. It had better be taken to the mortuary.
You leave that to us, sir. Get hold of his legs, Middleton. It's all right, lad. when you're ready.
Can I help in any way, Sergeant Harris?
If you could shine your lantern on the stairs for us, sir, that'd be much appreciated.